C1A, number 24A.
Now, last time we came as far as the tone of love as life, so that today, for the whole day, really is only left the subtone of love as truth and love as love. And you may perhaps feel that it's hardly worthwhile having a session on two undertones. But if we consider these two undertones in the textbook in proportion to the space they take within the chapter, we see that they must be rather important points, because the subtone of love as truth takes alone about 10 pages, which is nearly a short chapter in the textbook. So we can console ourselves that we are not spending this day on just a tiny little point, but on a very essential point. And to me, especially this tone of love and truth is a jewel in itself. It's a precious jewel of metaphysics. And so I tried again to epitomize those tones of love as truth and love as love in their subtones and sub-subtones, and have given to you just my jotting down to help you today. Because the structure of these two tones seems to be a bit involved at first sight. But as one ponders them, they stand out in a clarity and simplicity, but mostly in a grandeur that is overwhelming. And so I have only one wish for today, and that is that if there are a number of people handling three or four pages on their knees, doesn't always add much to the desert silence, so to say. So I would like you to be a bit careful when reading and handling these papers, that it doesn't disturb too much. But the main thing is that you use them, even if it gives a little bit of noise. Because I feel if you don't have them before your eyes, you may lose the thread of the whole thing. Now, how has the line of thought developed up to this point? And so let's quickly go over what has been presented before, and we just take quickly the main point of the chapter. You remember how we saw yesterday that the first five subjects of this chapter, the main tone of mind, spirit, soul, principle, and life, how they presented demands for atonement. The Christ demands for atonement, which said in the first, if you are one with the divine mind, stick to that divine mind, and therefore don't atone with any other mind, with any other God. If we do atone with this one mind, then the second subject leads us on and says, all right, then turn away from other gods. Have but one God. Turn but to the one spirit. And therefore turn away from matter, from flesh, from other gods, from a material center and circumference of being. Turn towards the imperishable things of spirit. And then the third subject came in and said, yes, that's the order and the direction of your atonement, so stick to it. And the subject of soul came and said, occupy till I come, stick to it, be constant, persevering it, don't go back, don't give in, stay with it, refuse all that which wants to take us away from this order and from this rule. And so if we have that sense of being tough, soul is always that thing which gives me a sense to be tough, be consistent and perseverant in the order of spirit, so that the rule of soul works itself out. But then we must say, in what shall I be perseverant? On what basis and for what purpose shall I be perseverant? So principle always comes in and gives the explanation of our basis, of our fundamental basis in which we have to persevere. And the fourth subject therefore showed us that if we want to be one with principle, we certainly have to disatone with anything which is opposite to a principle, namely to disatone with a human point of view of atonement, with a human interpretation of Jesus' life work, to disatone with a theological sense of atonement and what the crucifixion of Jesus meant and so on. That we have really to atone with the scientific sense of Jesus' atonement, of Jesus' exemplification of his principle. But as we do that, and as we see that we atone just with one principle and not with personal views, then naturally always this principle comes and says, I'm the only principle, and what I do, that's the only creation, that's the only life. And so Jesus came and proved this principle of atonement as life. He came to prove that God, that life is God, and proved it through his reappearance. And we came into that fifth subject where we saw that Jesus saw that oneness with a principle means oneness with a living principle, and therefore oneness with life. But that this life asks us to disatone, to break our covenant with a human sense of life, with a material sense of life, with the world's concept of life. Not a single component part could the world measure aright. That life, that demonstrating life, which is capital L, which is God, is demonstrating something very different than a glorified human sense of life, than a glorified concept or belief of the human sense of life. And so, yesterday, we spent quite a time then on that which flows out of such a new sense of life, namely truth, the birth of the new man. And we were considering how, if we accept the first five subjects of atonement to the point of the fifth subject of laying down a mortal concept of what constitutes life, of laying down a mortal sense of what principle wants us to express in being, and taking on a right sense of what principle wants us to express in life and in being, that then we can't help but expressing it. But then we can't help but express that new manhood that must flow out. Then out of this unity with the life which is God must flow a new sense of man, because a new sense of the Father must bring a new sense of the Son. We cannot hold a new sense of cause in our whole being, in our mind and feeling and attitude and motive and purpose and so on, and not have the effect of it. And so a new man is being born in us. And we spent quite a lot of time yesterday to see how we have to give birth to this new sense of man. So in the big picture, we can really see the structure of the chapter. The first five subjects present the demand to atone and to stick to the oneness. The sixth then gives us already the effect, the fruit, the outcome of fulfilling those demands, of fulfilling the laying down of the mortal concept. And so truth therefore shows the at one moment the God with us, and shows how the birth of the new man takes away the old concept of man. Then we come to the last subject, love, which starts right in and says, the design of love is to reform the sinner. And we at once begin to feel that what he is now trying to show here is that behind the whole chapter stands a divine purpose and not a human purpose. Stands a divine intention and not a human effort. That behind it stands a divine Christ force and not a moral effort. Meaning and showing, as we have seen yesterday, that if we go out from the first sentence of the chapter, namely that atonement exemplifies man's unity with God, that this is really the point of departure always, namely man's unity with God, and that if we are willing to let go through the first five subjects, all that which does not belong to this unity as our Eucharist, if we let willingly and happily and joyfully go what does not coincide with that unity, that then the at-one-ment in the sixth subject of God and man is brought to light, and being brought to light, we perceive that behind it was one big plan, one big purpose, driving toward a final aim, namely to establish that which from eternity always was, namely that man always one with God. So the last subject of love shows us that wonderful design of love, which from eternity to eternity is always at work to bring out in us the oneness of God and man. We feel now that it isn't a Mosaic demand which comes to us, or an ethical or moral demand that comes to us and says, now be a good boy or be a good girl and do your best and work up to your unity with God. No, it is always going out from the unity, from the eternal existing unity of principle and idea, which has a plan and says, I am love. I always draw my ideal to myself. I always do everything to draw my whole ideal, man, to my bosom. I'm love, I'm always as forcible, that I always force everything in such a way that the unity of man and God is brought out. I am love, and as love, I do it. I am the commander in the situation, and I am at the helm of everything. And because love can't help losing sight of loveliness, because love can't help being one with its idea, being wedded with its own idea, with its own ideal, it always works throughout eternity, throughout the centuries, throughout our life, throughout our every one of our experience. There is always love at the helm to work in her own way, so that we are always drawn closer and closer and closer to the realization of the eternal fact that was always established and always true about us, namely that we are one with God, that we are fundamentally already one with God, and that there is only a veil that hides us to go into the Shekinah, that there is only a veil that tries to keep us out from the holiest of holiest, that tries to keep us out from that intimate unity of principle and idea, God and man, God and the universe. So let us today take that, or try to have that attitude, that we are not laboring for a unity with God, but that fundamentally there is something much higher than our human and divine effort. The divine is at the helm, and the divine is constantly calling us and calling us to her bosom. Love calls her child always to her bosom. How does she show that? She shows it through the seven big subtones from which we have taken already five last time. And what did they show us? They showed that the divine fact that exists in beings, namely that love draws her idea to herself, protects her idea embosomed in her arms, that love therefore draws mind, the mind of mortals, to the divine mind. And we have seen in the first subject how she shows that love has a divine mind, and therefore forces the human mind, the worldly mindedness, to give up its false-mindedness and to accept and welcome the divine-mindedness. How we know that, what, first of all, what separates us to be one with that unity of God and idea is, first of all, that we don't believe it, that we have another concept about it, that in our mind there is a denial of it. And so love will force us through experience, through happening, through work, through demonstration, through all sorts of things, through suffering for the unjust, and so on, forces us and molds our thoughts and molds it and exalts it until it accepts that big tone that fundamentally mind, there is only one mind, and that that mind is one with God. So we can be quite sure that now or later, sooner or late, here or hereafter, that law, which has no time concept, that law is at work and works out, even to the human, the sense where we begin to see that in our mentality that we are one with God. Then she takes the second point, love as spirit. What does love as spirit accomplish in atonement? Love says, I never lose sight of spirit. And as a tone of atonement, of being at one and exemplifying this at oneness, this love never rests until we reflect love in every way. That's what she shows here. That love never rests and will never rest until all, in all ways, under all circumstances, will imitate the mighty works of He, the mighty life of He. That there is fundamentally only one fact true about God and the universe, namely that love never loses sight of spirit, or that love never loses sight of its full reflection, and therefore doesn't rest until the full reflection is brought out, until humanly, from the human standpoint, we accept that full reflection. Therefore, love will never rest us and leave us at peace because we are satisfied with reflecting only a little bit of love. Love is too loving to us that love will let us in peace with a little bit of good. Because in science, there is not a little bit of good or a bit more of good or a lot of good. There is only the idea good. Therefore, only the full reflection of good. And so we must be surprised if love forces us in all ways and means to reflect God in every way, to reflect the atonement of Jesus in every way. That's why he speaks first of the martyrs, because we can't go around the cup. We must even reflect that way of life which is willing to drink the cup, until at the end he shows that all that will do the work and imitate him and reflect God as a whole, or in its full reflect. So we can see what's waiting us. See, if at the moment we touch science, we can't get away anymore from it. We have to accept the whole impact of science. The moment we have studied science, the textbook in its science, we must be quite prepared that love has an interest on our mentality, that love is interested in our searching mind. And therefore, as lover's mind will not rest until we accept in mind love's plan. We can't get around that anymore. We are in for it. And second, we can't escape anymore that the fact that love is spirit, and that love has one plan and one intention and one big intention to bring out its full reflection everywhere, in everybody, in its full way, and in every way, under every circumstance. And so we are in for that experience that love will no more let us go until, willingly or unwillingly, through signs of suffering, we accept the full reflection of His way. But it's love behind. Because love just says to you, just says to each one of us, it says, I know you don't like to be perfect. I know it. Love says to each one of us, I know it's the hardest thing for you to be perfect, because you don't like to be perfect. You like to be how you like to be, but not to be perfect. The hardest thing the human has to overcome is to be perfect. The human doesn't like to be perfect. To accept perfection is one of the hardest things for the human. We always think the easiest thing will be to accept perfection. No, it's the hardest thing, because the human is against that. But love says, I love you so much. I love your searching, investigating mentality so much that I'm not resting until that is reflected fully. I love you. Because I love you, I chasten you. And because I love you, I chasten you, you may become a martyr, you may be persecuted, but that's all for the good. But finally, it is all for one big aim, that you reflect us as Jesus, the fullness of spirit. And then we came to love a soul. What does it say? Love is always love and never loses sight of soul. So love never loses sight of the spiritual selfhood of man, of our true spiritual satisfaction, of our sinless, non-suffering selfhood. Can you say non-suffering? Ah, that's good. Selfhood. See, that's what love is interested in. Love a soul is so much interest that the true sense of selfhood, of spiritual selfhood, which has never suffered, which is always satisfied, which is always fully satisfied with what it has in itself, that love is interested to bring that spiritual selfhood into focus and into birth and into and full blossom. And therefore, love is very much interested to work out her plans such that we are forced and are willingly or unwillingly, through signs of suffering, forced to give up another selfhood, except that selfhood which is divine self. So, in this paragraph, in this poem, we find that so clearly brought out how love forces us to accept that way from sense to soul. Or how love forces us to accept, to exchange the sense plane, the sense platform, for the spiritual sense platform. Or how love forces us to give up the sense testimony for a scientific testimony. You always see that translation from sense to soul. See, love forces us, each one of us, constantly. It is so interesting in us. Love the searching mind so much that it doesn't let it go anymore. And therefore says, well, as I'm love, I must find ways and means, and I will find ways and means to wean away every mortal, every sinner, from his false sense of selfhood, from his sense of, he forces us to go away, so to say, go forward from a suffering sense, from the sense of sin, of pleasures and pain, to accept that which is scientifically true, from sense to science. So we can always think, when things are a bit tough and seem painful, seem uneasy, we always must see that things never get uneasy except for the big fact that love does not want to let us go on in the old rut. If love wouldn't be love, if love would be hate or disinterestment, can you say that? Would be disinterest, you see. Then love would just let us go on floating in the old rut. But love does draw us to herself, and therefore does not want us to go on in the old rut, and therefore forces us either through signs or suffering to give up our old platform of sense testimony, of trying to see everything from the standpoint of the physical sense instead of the standpoint of scientific apprehension, and so forces us to change that sense, that salvation. When we came to the tone of love as principle, there again we must see, well, love is always love and is always at work and is always very awake and very interested in men. It always wants to draw men back. So it always wants to draw men back to its principled manhood, and so we can see that love never loses sight of principle. It never loses sight, therefore, that he proved the principle to be love. And there, as you remember, we had all those statements which show that love demands that we prove the divine principle to be love through giving the sign of love. That love doesn't rest until all our principled activity, our demonstration, our principled attitude is brought out in proof. Remember that it says, well, what are these signs that we really love God? How can we prove that our principle is love?